Once again, we scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roel Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Jonathan Tweet, our guest today on Scribble. Jonathan, I'm going to... Well, there are three things that occur to me. One is your Roel Tweet son, which I will not hold against you.
Thank you.
Two, you are writing a very interesting and I think rather unusual book. And three, the way you're publishing your book is almost even more interesting. Let's talk about the second. What prompted you to do Grandmother Fish?
Well, Grandmother Fish is the first book to teach evolution to preschoolers. And I've been thinking about how to teach evolution to preschoolers ever since my daughter was a preschooler 15 years ago. And over the years, I've worked on a manuscript and tried to get it in shape. And finally, about a year ago, figured out how to really make it work. And so this is, a very interesting creative challenge for me. How do you take a sophisticated and nuanced concept like evolution and make it appealing to little children?
Yeah, and that is, why do you think that's important to do in preschool?
Well, as soon as kids can look around at the world around them, they are interested in animals, they're interested in all sorts of living things. And what's beautiful about Darwin's story of evolution is that it affirms that we're all connected. We're all related to all the living things on Earth. And so I want children to be able to grow up seeing the world in that way.
Uh-huh. Well, that's an ambitious undertaking. You also had to get illustrations because you can't do a preschooler's book without...
You sure can't.
Yeah, you really need a lot of illustrations.
That's for sure.
How could you... I mean, what approach did you take? Whom did you get to do this?
Well, I'm very lucky to know Karen Lewis. She's the artist on the book, and she's actually a professional children's science illustrator. So her job is making illustrations that are scientifically valid, but are also appealing to children. And so this book is a natural for her, and when I first approached her about it, she knew right away that she would be able to contribute a lot to the project, and I think her work is turning out really wonderfully.
Yeah, it's how long did it take you to put all this together?
So, I've been working on the manuscript for 15 years. Karen and I started last spring, and mm-hmm. the book will be out in March, so a little under 12 months from when she and I got started to when people are going to have the finished book in their hands.
I especially like the illustrations. They have a feel of Northwest Indian myths.
Yeah.
I think the fish in there and the other animals.
It's a little stylized. Yeah. Simplified.
Yeah. It seems the style, it goes from very, very complete and complicated to some that look like preliminary sketches.
Well, so you are looking at their preliminary sketches. So that's a draft that we use to show people the story.
They're going to be fleshed out.
But when it's done, it'll be a full-color children's book, just like anything else you'd see on the shelves. That's right.
What kind of feedback are you getting from people in the field?
So there are quite a few... people who are interested in this book. For the first thing, I decided to raise money for it on Kickstarter because when I talked to people about this book, lay people, their eyes would light up and they were excited at the very idea of teaching evolution to preschoolers. But I was also able to contact a number of people in the science fields and science education, such as people at the National Center for Science Education, and they're all very supportive. They want to see more material like this available for children. And I was able to get some really good endorsements from Steven Pinker, Daniel Dennett, David Sloan Wilson, so people who are well-known in the evolution field.
You brought up the third point is how you got it published, but first of all, did you have any luck with publishers first? Did you try and go to conventional publishers?
So it had been my plan for years to take the manuscript to a regular publisher the way you're sort of supposed to do it. But I've done desktop publishing and self-publishing before, and I wanted to have complete control over the project. And I'd also heard from other evolution authors that publishers are not that keen about evolution books for children. A lot of schools won't touch the subject for grade school kids, and if you can't sell a kid's book into schools, that cuts your market down. And it's a controversial topic in a lot of places.
For many of us, particularly those who are in science, you think, how could this be controversial? But that's our problem. But now, Kickstarter. Why haven't you used Kickstarter? Please?
Because I didn't know a thing about it till he started doing this book. And it's still, there are ways in which I don't believe it. I can't imagine how this works. You want to explain how Kickstarter works?
Sure. So Kickstarter is a internet platform where any creative person can propose a project and a budget, and then people on the internet can back it, and they back it with a promise of money. And if the project earns the money for its budget, then it gets funded. That the backers get their credit cards charged, and the creative person gets the money, and they can do the project. And so that's what we did. We asked for $12,000. We said that if we can get $12,000, we can do the book. And we raised $36,000.
Oh, you can do two more books.
Yeah. Or one really good book.
Yeah.
So what does somebody who invests in you get out of this?
So we call the people who back us backers. It's not an investment like stock. But when you set up the project, you also specify how much people need to pledge in order to back you, and then what they get for those pledges. So our basic pledge was, if you back us for $25, you'll get a copy of the hardback book when it's done. And that's really where most of the money was raised. But we also had a special 10-pack offer where you were able to buy a large number of books all at once. And of course, that's good for us and good for anyone who wants to share them around. And a few people paid us hundreds of dollars in order to get their loved ones drawn into the book as characters. So when you're creating your Kickstarter, part of your project is finding different levels at which people can pledge. So the people who are really excited can pledge hundreds, and the people who are less excited can pledge less.
Backers can get into the book?
So on the last two-page spread is about today's humans. It starts with grandmother fish, and it goes to grandmother reptile, grandmother mammal, grandmother ape, and finally grandmother human. And then the last two-page spread in the story is a large number of humans. And some of those humans are people who paid to have their loved ones drawn in, or in one case, a cat.
That is ingenious.
Well, so now suppose somebody in the Quad Cities wanted to get a book published, and how would they even start Kickstarter?
So anybody can go to Kickstarter.com, set up an account. You do have to have an Amazon Payments account, but it's all very simple. And you fill out their forms that Kickstarter has online that where you describe what your project is, why you need the money, what the backer levels are, how much people need to pledge, what they get at each backer level. And they make it really easy for you. The hard part is coming up with the idea for the right project and then getting the word out about your project so that people will come and back it.
Now, when you tell people about your project, do you use a video presentation or do you just write about
That's
it?
That's a great question. Every project on Kickstarter has a page that's mostly text that describes the project and maybe who you are and why people should believe that you're capable of doing the project. But really the cornerstone of that page is a video. So if you could do a 2 or 3 minute video that shows who you are, shows you're a real and likable person, and gives you the opportunity to talk about your project and show how passionate you are, it's that video that really sells a project.
So you have to have some video capability. Of course, knowing so little about the whole world as it now operates, I suppose that capability is built into a lot of computers, isn't it?
Well, it's really easy to do a cheap video with your phone or a computer. In our case, we hired a videographer, and then he got a cut of our proceeds in exchange for his professional work. We had one very good video that was the cornerstone video of the page, and then he also did several other videos of us or for us, like children having the book read to them for the first time, and we got to see how they react. We saw a 6-year-old girl realize that the book was about her and about she was literally descended from a fish. And when the light bulb goes off over her head, you can see it in her face. It's really cute.
Yeah. I remember in embryology when, you know, the human embryo develops, you see the aortic arches.
Yeah.
The blood vessels that serve the aortic arches begin to form and then stop, except for one or two that go on to become a major vessel. It's as if in the human development we're remembering grandmother fish.
That's right, and we have gill slits when we're embryos.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
all those things, and people still don't want to think about this, but I think it's one of the most miraculous aspects of life.
Yeah, I agree.
The interconnection of everything.
Yeah.
So when is grandmother fish going to be on the market?
March.
In March.
Yeah, we have 1,000 backers. So we'll be shipping out books to them. We have backers all over the world. And then it will also be available online. And in fact, it can be pre-ordered right now with a link from our grandmotherfish.com website.
Jonathan, that's an amazing thing. Why don't you do amazing things like this tweet?
I'm wrapping my mind around trying to still believe it.
I see.
But apparently there are... I did subsequently check. There are people in the Quad Cities who are using Kickstarter to do projects like books or start a restaurant. I mean,
yeah, that's well, tweet. Let's think of something to start.
Well, you've got a lot of projects you could use some funding for.
Well, what we're going to start right now is the book bag. You've been reading any good books lately?
Yes, I have.
Okay, I'll turn your mic on. So,
okay.
I want to talk about a book that is in circulation right now that I have not read, but I'm dipped into it. It's called Strange Glory, The Life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It's by Charles Marsh, who's a professor of religious studies at the University of Virginia. And he deals here with one of the most significant figures in 20th century Christianity. Some people, you know, would argue that maybe it's Reinhold Niebuhr, but I think Dietrich Bonhoeffer is special, and this book makes a very strong case for that. Bonhoeffer was born on February the 4th, 1906, in Breslau. He was the 6th of 8 children born to Karl and Paula Bonhoeffer, and they were very well off. Dietrich lived a life that we would consider quite luxurious. Everything was at his disposal. And interestingly enough, even though he is considered a saintly figure, he was like that all his life. He lived with the best food, the best wine, the best services. Even when he was in prison, People would bring him champagne and food and so on. He did lead a very privileged life, but he had a very interesting take on Christianity that I think has bubbled up into our century and is beginning to make a real impact. Although his family was not religious, he startled them at the age of 13 by saying he was going to become a theologian. That was the last thing they expected. He was a brilliant student. He decided to study theology. He went to the University of Heidelberg, and he went to Berlin, and he aced everything. He studied the theology of the time, which was fairly doctrinaire and rigid, and almost immediately he began to feel a distancing from that sort of thing. He traveled. He traveled to France and to Italy. In Italy, he was much taken with the rituals and spirituality of Catholicism. He traveled to Spain. He came to the United States, Union Theological Seminary, one of the big, big Protestant schools in the country, but was more impressed with Abyssinian Baptist Church.
The black churches in New York.
Yeah.
I mean, that was, for him, life-changing.
That was. That really did change his life. And there's a wonderful statement. See if I can find it. Religion plays the part of the parlor into which one does not mind withdrawing for a couple of hours, but from which one immediately returns to one's business. And he thought, no, that's not
religion. That's right.
It's not the message and all the theological complications and obligations and rituals. It's the messenger. It was the life of Jesus, and that's what we should live. So he moved away from the strictures of religion into, you might call it a primitive Christianity, but certainly it went right back to the source of it. And that got him in trouble. He went to Germany, came back to Germany, and tried to change things there. No luck. Tried to, in the face of Nazism, become ecumenical. He did not see any distinction between Christians and Jews or anybody else.
Right.
They were all God's children, and they were all to be served and loved and so on. But then matters got so bad in Germany that he toyed with the ideas of Reinhold Niebuhr, who talked about it was possible to sin for the sake of righteousness. And he took a peripheral role in the plot to eliminate Hitler. And he kind of got away with that for a while, but he was on the SS's radar. But then when there was an assassination attempt, things got serious. And he was taken into a concentration camp, and then later transferred to Flossburg Prison, where he was executed on April 9th, 1945. His life and his example, even though this is a man who wore silk underwear all the time, you know, had a
right.
motorcycle and a luxury car and so on, yet he never, ever strayed away from the central message of Jesus' ministry, not of the theology that was built on it, but the ministry itself. And that more and more people are feeling that this is something we really ought to go to. And so that's why for a number of people, he is the central figure in 20th century Christianity. And Strange Glory is a book that I think you would enjoy reading. As I say, it's...
Along with his book, Letters and Papers from Prison.
Yeah, that's true.
That's really an eye-opening book. And I know many, I mean, it's a favorite Lutheran thing to do is to study Bonhoeffer, because he led a small group of Lutheran pastors who, you know, while the state church caved into Hitler and essentially supported the Nazi regime, he was part of a small group of evangelicals that refused.
You know, that's one of the to us, incomprehensible things, that Catholics and Lutherans turn to Nazism.
They didn't turn. I don't think they had a choice. Well, they did.
They had a choice.
Because he had a choice, too.
Yeah, but they took the lead of some of their leaders.
Yes,
and one of the things that made it possible I believe, is because the widespread and deep antagonism toward Jews all the way through Europe. And that was part and parcel of Christianity from the beginning. When the early Christians tried to set themselves apart from the troublesome Jews, and then, you know, the antagonism just went on, the persecutions and so on, and that was deep-seated in Europe. It really was. But Bonhoeffer had the vision and the spirit to set himself apart from that. So it's a great book. If you want the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, there are others, but Strange Glory by Charles Marsh is, I think, a book you'll find deeply satisfying. You have any books that you're
Well, I've got
in?
One book that is recommended by Elizabeth Hunt, and it's interesting because you find out in the course of this book that Mark Twain wasn't always truthful.
Oh, really?
This is a book written 2 years ago by Lee Sandlin, it's called Wicked River, the Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild. And it covers essentially the time of the Mississippi when Mark Twain covers in Life on the Mississippi, but it tells the truth about the brothels and the, you know, and the gambling and the prostitution and everything else, including Davenport's own Bucktown, right? Every river town. So the river was a lot more wicked than Mark Twain's little cleaned-up version that you get in Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn.
Rock Island used to get a lot of, you know, people looking down on it from Davenport, and I think, don't you know your own history?
who was it? Some Catholic bishop called Davenport the wickedest city for its size in America in something like 1902.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But this is a book that tells you what life on the Mississippi was really like from 1900 to 1800 to 1850, when the height of the steamboat, just before the Civil War.
Yeah, I've seen that book, Wicked River. It is very, very good.
It is funny. It is really well written. Twain, you know, it wasn't his purpose to tell the truth about the river. His purpose was to tell the truth about human nature, but it's an interesting read.
Yeah, it is. Well, there are two that you can take with you: Strange Glory, The Life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Wicked River, which is about that naughty, naughty river and all the shenanigans that took place along it. And those two books we recommend to you, and we remind you that we're always happy to have your recommendations for books you've especially enjoyed. Well, that will take leave of you for another week. We'll be back next week for more books, more guests, more about reading and writing on Scribble. I'm Don Wooten for Roll Tweet. See you next week.